Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good morning and welcome to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Peter Mayer's with you. Today I speak to Philip Gurevich, editor of the Paris Review, about the latest edition of the literary magazine, which features, among other things, a revealing interview with Umberto Eco. New Zealand writer Emily Perkins talks about her novel Within a Novel, the story of a scriptwriter struggling to come to terms with the death of his wife by attempting to bring her back to life in words. We review Jhumpa Lahiri's latest collection of short stories, Unaccustomed Earth, and continue our first-person reading, 13-Ton Theory, the biography of a rock band, Hunters and Collectors, by its lead singer, Mark Seymour. Italian novelist and scholar Umberto Eco has 30,000 books in his Milan apartment and another 20,000 volumes in his country manor. The author of Foucault's Pendulum and The Name of the Rose is a man of prodigious intellect, fluent in several languages, with an encyclopedic knowledge of medieval history. So you'd never guess what Il Professore likes to watch on TV. Starsky and Hutch. That's right, the clunky, at times slapstick 1970s police buddy drama featuring two badly dressed Californian cops in need of a good haircut. Umberto Eco's taste in TV is one of the more trivial things to emerge from a long and fascinating interview with the author, published in the current edition of the literary magazine The Paris Review. The latest issue also includes a moving recollection of a friendship by American writer Paula Fox and the diary of a fire lookout who spends his summers on top of a tower on top of a mountain in a New Mexico national park watching for smoke. The editor of the Paris Review is Philip Gurevich, a regular guest on the book show. Philip Gurevich, welcome again to ABC Radio National.
It's good speaking with you.
In this interview, Umberto Eco does come across as a very charming and very funny man.
Yes, he seems to be somebody who, I think he's somebody who takes great pleasure in both his erudition and his ability to carry on a kind of rambunctious, lively, versatile conversation, to ricochet around, to make bad puns, and to generally exhibit a mixture of his intellect and his opinions very, very, very informatively. I think it's kind of remarkable how engaging somebody can be who is reaching for a broad audience from the unlikely position of being a medievalist scholar of Christianity.
Indeed. I mean, he's the author of several novels, of course, as well as all his scholarly work on semiotics and medieval history. But surprisingly, he didn't grow up with books.
Yeah, I actually found in many ways some of the things in the interview that were the most moving and most interesting and most surprising were the stories of his own childhood, of his father, an accountant, and the father's father, a typographer. The father of Umberto Eco, was the eldest of 13 children, and he comes across as a man who grew up around engaging people, but utterly unfamiliar with the literary sort of milieu or hyper-intellectual milieu or cosmopolitan milieu that he later came to inhabit. I mean, when he's asked where he was born, he says simply, it was in the town of Alessandria, and it's known for its Borsellino hats.
The thing he says is that he developed a passion for the Middle Ages the same way some people develop a passion for coconuts. Now, I've never met anyone with a passion for coconuts, so I'm not quite sure what he means, but I guess he means he just fell in love with that period in history.
Yeah, I don't think that the best I can make of it, other than it being as much of a deflection of it as an answer, is that he's really saying, there's no accounting for it. It is a great passion for me, but I'm not going to try and explain that the Middle Ages is something that, you know, one should reasonably fall in love with, so much as that it's a passion, and that it's a consuming passion, that it corresponds to his omnivorous appetite for getting to know everything about a society and everything about its time and sort of reconstructing it. We ran in this interview a number of the doodles and sketches and charts that he drew in his notebooks when he was writing what is clearly his most famous book, The Name of the Rose. And there are sketches of monks. There are things that look an awful lot like Sudoku puzzles, but are in fact mappings of church interiors and the riddles that go with their architecture. He can't get enough of the mechanics of all of this.
No, indeed. I mean, they're quite remarkable, those drawings, and you get a sense of the level of engagement he has. I mean, he describes the Middle Ages as a luminous time, which is rather surprising since we tend to see it as a fairly dark period in history.
I suppose that it's a luminous time if you're looking back in it for, I mean, there were certainly great scholars, there was certainly great inventiveness, and there was a very low life expectancy. It was a time, I can't imagine getting nostalgic for it. I can imagine being fascinated by it, and He seems to blend the two a little bit.
Well, he does say he'd rather imagine the Middle Ages than live in them, because he'd probably be dead by now if he was living in them. But I think
with his appetites, he would be.
He's asked about the similarities, which have been commented on a lot, between his The Name of the Rose and Dan Brown's blockbuster The Da Vinci Code, and his response is again very witty. He says that Dan Brown is in fact his own invention.
That's right. He says that the author Dan Brown is a character from Foucault's Pendulum. I invented him. He shares my character's fascinations. The world conspiracy of Rosicrucians, Masons, and Jesuits, the role of the Knights Templar, the hermetic secret, the principle that everything is connected. I suspect Dan Brown might not even exist.
Controversially, he says that the historical novel isn't so much a fictionalized version of real events as a fiction that will actually enable us to better understand the real history. Do you go along with that?
Well, I think it certainly makes a lot of sense. I don't know if I would say that it doesn't fictionalize real events, but I think that a novel is only interesting if it does help us imagine reality. And in that sense, the historical novel is no different. A novel, fiction in general, seems to me to bear with nonfiction the burden of being truthful and recognizable and helping us enlarge our understanding of who and what we are. And so if a novel is set in a historical period and it seems merely to be a costume drama, it seems to me to be neither a useful illumination of history, because history probably wasn't a costume drama, nor does it seem to be much use as a novel that tells us about who we are and what we are. But just like reading very, very good history, reading very good historical novels illuminate the human condition in our time just as much as in that time, because, oddly, it hasn't changed quite as much as we might like to think, despite the costume changes.
The interview with Umberto Eco is by Le Monde writer Leila Azam Zangane, and it appears in the current edition of the Paris Review, which is edited by Philip Gurevich, who's my guest on The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Philip Gurevich, I also want to talk about Paula Fox's piece in the Paris Review. I haven't read Paula Fox before. She's a children's writer. She also writes novels for adults, and she's written memoir exploring her own difficult childhood. Paula Fox is in her 80s, and she's undergone something of a revival in popularity of her writing in recent years.
Well, I think that's probably true, which is to say that in the 1970s, I think it was, she wrote a novel called Desperate Characters that's really just simply an outstanding novel. It's a novel, broadly speaking, about a woman living in Brooklyn, New York, who is bitten by a cat. That doesn't maybe sound like the most compelling engine for a piece of really perceptive social fiction, but it is, because it's about somebody who's living a sort of seemingly settled bourgeois life, a little bit on the bohemian edge. She's everything seems fine, and then one day her own cat bites her, and it sets in motion a whole series of events and fears and preoccupations, and it becomes, I mean, I don't know how else to put it, but a little bit like a very different stylistically, but almost like a Mrs. Dalloway, a kind of very close interior examination of this woman's psyche and of the times. She is also a children's writer and a memoirist, but I think at a certain point the novelist Jonathan Franzen stumbled across Desperate Characters really somewhat by accident, and he simply couldn't understand how a novel this good was something that he hadn't heard of before, and he started touting it around to various people and realized that not too many had ever heard of it either. He's the one I first heard about it from. And then sometime, I don't know, in the mid to late 90s, he actually wrote an essay in which he drew attention to it, and that did have a considerable effect on bringing her to the attention of a new generation of writers as really one of our living masters. She's absolutely masterful, gifted, perceptive, thoughtful writer.
Her piece in the Paris Review is about a friendship with a neighbor called Jack.
That's right. It's
a beautiful piece of writing. It's restrained, but it's not distant.
It's not at all distant. It's a very revealing story. It's a story about a kind of romance that is actually a friendship. It's not. It never becomes a love affair. And in fact, Jack turns out to be a gay man, and it becomes a very close friendship, and a friendship that interweaves and intersects with phases of her own romantic history and background, so that one sees not only him, but one sees her own life unfolding, and part of its power is that it is not only a memoir and a reminiscence and a memorial to this man who has eventually died, but is also, it covers such a number of decades. I think that's part of its power, that in its restrained power, you feel the weight of all that time, and you feel the arc of these lives being revisited in a very compressed and compact and unself-dramatizing but extraordinarily perceptive way.
And the imagery is fantastic. I mean, she visits Jack in hospital when he's dying, and she writes, "He had lost a lot of weight and looked as sick as he was. As he gripped my hand, I felt his strength return momentarily, then fade, so that his fingers felt like a handful of pencils." It's a very powerful image.
Yeah. She's a remarkable descriptive writer. And I remember when I first read it, till now, just very vividly the sense of her first encounters with him as a neighbor, wondering what it was that he wanted, because he clearly was sort of available for friendship. Her own slight displacement and loneliness, and him as this neighbor in a kind of New York that doesn't really exist anymore. She's very good at evoking that mid-century New York of before New York became too expensive to live in unless you were rich, or at least highly employed, you know, where there was a kind of bohemian presence and a lot of people of modest and lower middle class means living there and getting to know their neighbors in these apartment buildings. That's also somewhat the territory of desperate characters, but the intimacy of this as a memoir is really very striking.
Paula Fox's piece in the Paris Review is called The Tender Night, a reference to F. Scott Fitzgerald. Philip Gurevich, I just wanted to also mention a third piece, which will be of interest to many Australians because it's about bushfires, and that's a topic close to us. Philip Connors wrote it. He gave up his job as a copy editor to spend a summer as a fire lookout, sitting on top of a tower on top of a mountain in a national park in New Mexico, looking out for smoke. Lots of solitude and lots of time to think. It's a bit like being a lighthouse keeper.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's actually an American literary tradition that covers this. Gary Snyder, the great poet, and in his term, Jack Kerouac.
Henry David Thoreau, I guess, even Walden.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, but specifically fire watching and fire spotting. It's one of the few places that you can actually get a little bit of a salary to go sit in the middle of the wilderness in a tiny cabin. And obviously we've got a lot of wilderness here, the Gila Wilderness on the Mexican border in New Mexico, where Phil Connors spent his summers. He ended up, as you say, taking this job for one summer, and then he kept returning year after year after year, so that I think that by the time he writes this piece, he's in his sixth summer. And what's remarkable about it is it starts out, it also has a quiet way of building on one. And at first it just seemed to me, okay, this is interesting. He's going to be writing about sitting up there and watching for fires and what it's like to be alone and what it's like to be in the wilderness, and we'll get some good nature writing. And then he actually starts talking about fire, and he starts talking about how fire is not necessarily a crisis in nature, but is part of a cycle in nature, where the fires come and they cause the grasses to renew, and you usually get a better growth of grasses the following year, which in turn feeds herds like the herds of bison that used to occupy that part of this country, and the Great Western Buffalo Range. And his job is to spot fires and alert the firefighting teams that then sometimes come in with planes, with chemical sprays and so forth to hose them down. They drop in and bring firefighting teams with chainsaws and so forth to cut fire breaks.
Indeed, he describes it as a full-scale techno-industrial war on fire.
Yeah, and he starts to wonder, am I actually protecting nature or am I interfering with it? And perhaps, what's so bad about letting this go on by itself, and why? Whether he's actually, I mean, he's very pleased to be out there in the middle of the wilderness, but is the pleasure of this solitude coming at some sort of expense to what makes sense? And he really draws that question out and then turns a really remarkable change on it as he himself then becomes attached to an orphaned deer fawn, a fawn that he comes upon in the forest and wants to rescue. And of course, it's exactly the opposite of the impulse he's having about fires, which is let them burn. Isn't that the natural thing? But when people say to him, look, leave the deer alone, let it fend for itself, don't intervene, he feels that that's just a heartless and mindless response. And so the essay ricochets on this kind of large, almost public policy and wilderness policy level to the kind of most personal response to nature, back and forth in a way that's really very illuminating and surprising.
Philip Gurevich, we won't tell listeners what happens with the fawn. They can read that in the Paris Review. Thank you very much for joining us again on The Book Show.
Thanks for talking to me.
And if you're in Melbourne, you can see Philip Gurevich at the Melbourne Writers Festival later this week. He'll be appearing at several events, talking about literary journals with some other leading editors of literary publications, and also discussing his latest book, Standard Operating Procedure, talking about what went wrong at Abu Ghraib. You'll find a link to the Melbourne Festival program on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. On ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Peter Mayers. Now a novel about a mysterious death. New Zealand writer Emily Perkins' book Novel About My Wife is set in London, where the author lived for 10 years. It takes the point of view of scriptwriter Tom Stone, whose career has stalled and whose life doesn't match his middle-class aspirations. What we read is his account of the events that led up to the death of his wife Anne. But he's also writing a novel about his wife, so it's a novel within a novel. Writing is Tom's way of coming to terms with Anne's absence and his way of reconstructing the events that led to her death. This is a mystery of sorts. Tom knows why Anne died, though he failed to see the warning signs. But as readers, we remain uncertain until the end about the cause of her death. Was she mentally ill, or was she really being stalked? Sarah Lestrange spoke to Emily Perkins for The Book Show, and Emily Perkins begins by reading from the beginning of her book, Novel About My Wife.
If I could build her again using words, I would, starting at her long, painted feet and working up, shading in every cell and gap and space for breath until her pulse couldn't help but kick back into life. Her hip bones, her red knuckles, the soft skin of her thighs, her fine crackle of hair, that long red hair, the shock of it spread out on the floor. I loved her boredom, her glazed look, her dark laugh, her eyes, the way she moved around things, gliding very near, the warmth that emanated from her skin. Everybody gives up warmth, but with Anne it had a special quality, as though she was heat-seeking heat, threatening to touch you in the spirit of danger, on a dare. She'd stand in the gutter, off the curb, while she was waiting to cross the road. Buses skimmed past. She didn't flinch. She wasn't one of those women who hate their feet, who hate their bodies, the kind who turn the sight of their ass in broad daylight into a state secret. God, you just find yourself dying for a glimpse. You'll do anything to get it. Hover outside the bathroom door, hide under a table, pull back the sheets when she's sleeping. Anne didn't care. Her body was open for viewing. It was one of the ways she distracted you from what was inside her head. And her feet weren't perfect. They were long and dry, with knobbly toes and a verruca on one heel, which never went away because she refused to do anything but laugh about it. She liked pedicures, massage, that slightly sickening world of female self-obsession, and went in for toenail polish and dark back-off shades. The lightning bolt scar on her right arm was a bubble-edged disaster, a memento of youth that she kept covered up. What you couldn't take your eyes off were her legs. She had a sexy stance and walk, sort of hollow around the waist and jutty at the hips, shoulders slumped forwards. Well, now that I see it written down, it makes her sound like a gorilla, but it was more sort of slutty flapper. Bear with me. I can't look at Anne in terms of the bare bones. She was this kind of person, she was that. Her parents were whatever, the house she grew up in was blah. It isn't going to work. And partly because there's so much I don't know. It was Anne's mystery I fell for. Her genuine mystery, not the cultivated kind so many of the English girls had.
So writes Tom Stone as he reconstructs his dead wife in words, and so writes Emily Perkins in her novel about my wife. So this is Tom Stone rebuilding his wife who has died. He's grieving. He's a script writer and he's insecure about his place in the world. He hasn't reached the level of success he was hoping for. But would you say he's filled with regret, Emily Perkins, for not noticing the signs that led to his wife's death?
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's what a large part of the book is for him, is a sort of writing his way towards a discovery of his wife. And I think it becomes increasingly apparent to him that he had his chance while she was there in the room with him, and it's very possibly too late. So I do think regret's a big part of the novel.
And in writing this novel, he also includes excerpts that are in typewriter font. Why did you choose to make Tom Stone write in that way?
Well, what he's trying, it's one of the ways in which he really tries to discover Anne. And because he's a writer, it's natural to him to try to write her. So the bulk of the book, if you like, is his non-fiction account of what's gone on. And the bits that are in the typewriter font are his attempts at fictionalising and novelising a part of their life, the part of their life when they got married, and trying to work out around the events that took place then what might have been going on in Anne's head. So without wanting to sound too technical, he starts writing her in the third person, and himself in the third person, in an attempt to try and embody her a bit more.
But in the process of reading this novel, we get inside Tom Stone's head as well, not just Anne's. He's got quite a few hang-ups, dear Tom. And he's, as we've said, he's not very happy with where his life has ended up. I was a bit repulsed by him, but I also liked his self-awareness. Did you like him?
I did, and it's funny because there is something, you know, really dreadful about his sort of parochialism and his lack of empathy for others or compassion. His neurosis is, you know, he's terribly self-obsessed, but I do like him nevertheless. He's got a self-awareness, he's got a very mordant take, I suppose, on the world around him. He feels as much that he's critiquing his kind of middle class aspirations as he is a victim of them. And I suppose I feel for him because he's in a very tragic situation, and it's one that's not directly of his own making, but it's one that he could possibly have done more to prevent.
Which we'll get into in a minute, but in terms of this self-awareness, one part I particularly liked is the way that he described himself. He talks about himself as the guy writing a cheesy genre film on spec, the sort of loser they make indie documentaries about, documentaries that are watched by people like my former successful self in crowded screenings at film festivals. That's the sort of self-awareness we're talking about.
Yes, I think he does have that sort of, I mean, he's partly, I suppose, having a midlife kind of meltdown, and he's aware of his own failure to live up to his former expectations, yeah.
And the failure to figure out what was going on with his wife and what led to her death.
I mean, I suppose also in his defence, there are a lot of circumstances around that failure that aren't of his own making. I mean, they are under a lot of financial pressure. They're at that stage in life where they're, you know, they've got their first big mortgage and they're expecting their first child. And I think he feels an enormous responsibility to that, as well as he feels this responsibility to his own career, which again, through no real fault of his own, starts to into free fall quite near the beginning of the novel. So there, it's not just his his selfishness or his inability to look. He's got paying attention to a lot of other quite necessary things as well.
And part of that is because we can only know what's going wrong in hindsight. Mm. And so he is trying to reconstruct that, what went wrong. And delusion seems to be a central theme in this book. We wonder if Anne is delusional about the man who is following her. It's not really clear till the end what exactly is going on, although you get inklings. Are there other parallels to this theme of delusion in the book?
Well, there is. It is a general theme. And what I'm interested in, I guess, is what we choose as the object of our delusion and how we often manifest our own fears in terms of outside threats when we really might do better to look at threats that are a little bit closer to home or closer to the truth. So I think that's something that recurs within the novel. You might think that certain elements, from everything from something that might be inside your body to something that's outside your front door, might be posing some kind of danger to you, when in fact where the danger lies might seem to be, on the surface, much more benign.
So the threats, the external threats like muggings and being attacked by people with road rage, that sort
yes.
of thing.
Yes, yeah, you know, having, I mean, Tom has that general middle class fear of the underclass. I mean, he's afraid, he associates violence with the underclass, and he doesn't see its potential other sources, I think, that he might be much, much closer to. So that's one way, I suppose, of projecting a general fear onto something that you don't feel, he doesn't feel that he belongs to. And of course, because he lives in London and because he's a screenwriter and, you know, money's an issue for him, they live in an area that's in the very early stages of gentrification, and I think he feels a little bit out of his comfort zone in terms of the neighbourhood.
And Anne's own delusions of ghosts in the house, these are also things you're exposing as well. But it's this crucial thing of his prejudices against the things that Anne believes that, in a way, prevents him from actually seeing what is going on. So something that comes out in this novel is the role of dialogue between couples, or the lack of it.
That's right. I think it's often in relationships between couples, you're actually having conversations silently, you know, an awful lot of the time, and what gets spoken is generally, you know, often fairly mundane, or it's about other people or other things or politics, or, you know, it's off the topic of what's going on between you, because you can't, in a committed long-term relationship, constantly take its temperature all the time. I mean, it would be maddening to do so. And so there's an awful lot that's internalised.
Your eye is very much focused on the middle classes in London, even though you're a New Zealander, you lived there for 10 years or so. This book is portraying creative professionals in their late 30s, Anne about to have her first baby at 39. She's described as being part of a generational trend, a colour-coded statistic in a magazine article. You're bringing a certain demographic to life as well. What's your interest in the middle classes as a fictional subject?
Well, you know, I'm a member, I suppose. And so I just find middle-class aspirations and sense of entitlement provide a lot of, I don't know, potential humour and areas for social examination.
As you say, Emily, in this novel about my wife that you've written, it's sort of reflecting perhaps your own social milieu. Do you see yourself as writing for your generation with each phase of life? You reflect that in literature?
It's funny, I think probably with this book I have to acknowledge that I'm turning out to be that kind of writer, and I mean, I don't want to limit myself at all, but it's very true that I'm interested in what is, I suppose, around me and the stages of life that I experience and know about. And, you know, between my last book before this and this novel, I've had children and, you know, I've got married and all that sort of thing, and there is a whole sort of new area of life that I've got experience in and I'm interested in putting down in fiction.
In fact, I've read that you've tried to write historical fiction, but it didn't work for you. So there must be a value in reflecting society back at them in a fictional sense.
Well, I hope so. I mean, it's interesting with historical fiction because I would be drawn to, you know, the right story being set in the right time. But there is just so much that interests me about the way we live now that it's hard to imagine losing interest in that and having to cast about in history for something else.
You've returned to New Zealand after your time in London. What's that been like for you as a writer?
Oh, it's been really good, actually, and interesting in unexpected ways because, you know, I love London and I love the whole sort of book world there. I wrote half this book while I was still living there and finished it back here. So in that sense, it's been good having the geographical distance and being able to write an imaginary London. But also in a more general way as a writer, New Zealand's a lot more quiet than London, so I've got more time to read, more time to think, less of a fun social life, but probably a better working life, I'd say.
New Zealand writer Emily Perkins speaking to the Book Show's Sarah Lestrange about her new novel, Novel About My Wife. Emily Perkins is also the author of a collection of short stories, Not Her Real Name, and the novels Leave Before You Go and The New Girl. She'll be appearing at the Melbourne Writers' Festival this weekend. On ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. I'm Peter Mayers. The judges for the world's richest short story prize, the Frank O'Connor Award, thought Jhumpa Lahiri's latest collection, Unaccustomed Earth, was so good they didn't bother making a shortlist. They just gave her the prize outright. And it seems they did pick a winner because the book has reached number one on the New York Times bestseller list. This isn't the first prize Jhumpa Lahiri has won for her short stories. She won a Pulitzer for her collection Interpreter of Maladies. She's also written a novel called Namesake, which was made into a film. What does our reviewer Anna Hedigan think of Unaccustomed Earth? Here she is to tell us.
Versatility in short story collections sometimes has the whiff of tent show evangelism about it. Acrobat shifts in voice, style and content can seem a little desperate to convert us. US writer Steve Almond comes to mind, whose books are like wandering through the crowd at an alternative festival like Lollapalooza, bumping into beautiful freaks. Plenty of writers use short story to play games in the form. Short shorts, formalism, overt slapstick or supernaturalism. The brevity of our engagement with the world created in each small capsule of story allows for freedoms that would be too difficult to swallow in a longer format. To stretch a metaphor, such an approach risks the same outcome as poorly integrated ingredients on a clever tastings menu. Everything seems like an amuse-bouche. Nothing really lingers. Jhumpa Lahiri's Unaccustomed Earth displays a confidence that sits in sharp contrast to this. It's a suite of stories like variations on a musical motif, building into a richer whole. In a way, she starts every story from the same place. A family, Bengali immigrants whose children have grown up American. The sharp pain of unexpected grief and the unresolvable difficulty of loosening blood ties when it's time to step away and accept adulthood. Each story takes a different path, and the author is exceptionally skilled at handling the trajectory of individuals so that as a reader, one never feels they are manipulated into false dramatic scenarios. The choices they make are agonisingly real and imperfect. They hope for the best in others when such expectations are fantastical, or keep repeating behaviour they can't seem to shake. They are pragmatic or contrary. They do what they must do as individuals built of the thousand experiences that have shaped their characters. There is a monumental sense of whole lives sitting behind the brief visits we make with them. I'm reluctant to dissect a couple of stories from this collection and gloss over the others, as I'd hate to give the impression that some were buffed to a high polish and others merely fillers. Everything here is strong. Lahiri writes stories that would be considered too long for Australian journals. The title story runs 70-odd pages, but they never drag. She builds worlds of detailed gestures. The slightly fussy domestic routines of an ageing widower counterpoint the necessary economies and neuroses of his thoroughly American daughter, busy at home with a young baby. The conservatism of first-generation immigrant Bengalis is revealed by their disapproval of the looser ways of old friends who return to India and come back for a visit to the US drinking whiskey and rejecting thrift. Friends who haven't had their values frozen at the moment of departure from India 20 years before. Lahiri is a London-born Bengali who grew up in the USA, and although this clearly influences her choice of protagonists, the stories explore family and isolation far more deeply than cultural integration issues would suggest. The title of the collection is taken from Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Custom House, which argues that human nature will be improved by the transplanting of family to new locations to, quote, strike their roots into unaccustomed earth. But Lahiri seems unsure that such an experience is always for the better. The grown families of these stories are testament to her interrogation of the better life that is the promise of the American dream. Like the best work of Anne Tyler, Unaccustomed Earth will chime for anyone who grew up outside a Petri dish. For example, Lahiri captures the gulf that widens between hard-working, aspirational parents and their affluent, better-educated children, a distance that not only immigrant families struggle to bridge. Characters reach out to each other and are rebuffed or long for certainty. Sometimes things work out okay too. Disasters are mitigated by time and kindness exists. Who is your favourite contemporary Australian short story writer? Unless you're one of the small number of people who read literary journals or whom purchase anthologies or that rare creature here, a single author short story collection, you may not have one at all. None of the Australian print media seem willing to take a regular punt on short fiction either. Why not? Is the short story the literary equivalent of all bran? Good for you, but who wants to eat it really? The US short story market is a real contrast to ours, and Lahiri is considered a worthy heir to ageing or departed masters like Updike, Carver, Beattie and Munro. Short stories there are not considered marketing poison, and a whole crop of younger writers, Juno Diaz, David Sedaris, Edward Danicat and George Saunders, to name a few, seem to be able to move between longer form and short story collections without skipping a beat with their reading audiences. I hope this book sells very well here. It might convince local publishers to take a chance on Australian writers whose passion for the form is undiminished, without needing to dress them up with ill-fitting themes or force them into anthologies as instantly outdated as a washable Lollapalooza tattoo.
Anna Hedigan with her review of Unaccustomed Earth by Jhumpa Lahiri. It's a Bloomsbury book distributed by Allen & Unwin. This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.